and welcome back to Radio Times. If you're a baby boomer, chances are you watched the TV series Superman that was popular back in the 1950s.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Superman.
Well, this year marks the 75th anniversary of Superman that was first chronicled in comic books and on radio, TV, and of course in film. The latest movie, Man of Steel, debuted earlier this month. It was made for a whopping $225 million, and it looks like it's well on its way to turning a profit. What is the appeal of Superman, a character created in the depths of the Depression by two young men from Cleveland, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster? How have his image and the storylines changed over the decades, and what about this new blockbuster? We have two guests who have joined us. Larry Tai is the author of a book called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. And Larry Tai, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Also with us is Robert Thompson, professor of television, radio, and film at Syracuse University, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse. And Bob Thompson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Larry Tai, let me begin with you, and let's begin with Man of Steel. Did you like this movie?
I did. I didn't like it as much as I had hoped to, and I think that it will do what Warner Brothers wanted, which is not just to earn north of $1 billion, which is their standard for success of this movie, but to be the setup for a bunch of sequels, the same way the Christopher Reeves movies were.
And it's interesting, Bob Thompson, it's not called, there's no word Superman in the title of this new Superman movie, it's just Man of Steel. What did you make of this new incarnation?
Well, it's interesting. You played those that music in the opening and talked about how baby boomers knew that show from the 1950s, 52 to 58. And we did. I'm a baby boomer, and I watched that show. But I have to say, that program never got me into the myth of Superman, nor did the comic books that much. It wasn't until the Christopher Reeves movies came out that I began to really see the appeal of Superman. And I think this movie managed, especially in the beginning, before the mayhem and the computerized apocalypse happens, to really get into what I think is so appealing, not only about Superman in particular, but the superhero genre in general.
And what is particularly appealing about the Superman superhero genre?
Well, I think for so many people, and I think this actually goes to vampires and all the rest of it, but this idea, this fantasy that you're a regular person living in the world, but you're able to do things other people can't do. I think anybody, including the creators of Superman, who have felt bullied or on the periphery or whatever, this idea that you could have these superpowers, and of course you always fantasize that you're going to use them for good purposes, is, I think, a really appealing one. I always find the adolescent era of having superpowers to be the most interesting, because in so many ways it's when you most want them.
And do you think, Larry Tai, that it helps to explain this 75 years of Superman?
Yeah, I think what really helps to explain it is if you go back to the beginning with Jerry Siegel and what he was trying to do, we were never quite sure what he had in mind until, in the course of writing my book, somebody leaked to me a 150-page unpublished memoir that Jerry had wrote explaining what it was all about at the beginning. And I think his story of the creation suggests just why it's tapped a nerve that's lasted for 75 years. And if you have a minute, I'd love to tell you the story
Sure.
that he tells about why he came up with the character.
Absolutely.
And it goes back to his days on the playground when he was growing up in a neighborhood of Cleveland, Ohio called Glenville that was 70% Jewish. And every day when Jerry would go out on the playground, he was a little bit too short, and he was a little bit too round. and he wore glasses that looked a little bit too much like Coke bottles. And when he would be out there, the kids would taunt him. They would yell, "Seagull, seagull, birds of an eagle." Mm. Now, I have no idea what that means, but I know that if you're a little boy out in the playground and all the girls are watching the other boys taunt you, what you wish you could do is fly away. And he couldn't fly away, but what he could do is every night when he would go to bed, he would bring with him a pencil and paper. And he would sketch out his notion of what a hero would look like. And the first character that he came up with was somebody that he called the Super-Man. Huh. And it was not a very nice guy. It was precisely the kind of tough, very strong hero that a little bullied boy in the playground would invent and would help him fight back against the other heroes. And that is what Superman looked like for several years until Jerry turned 17. And not long after his 17th birthday, something very traumatic happened to him. His dad owned a haberdashery, a used clothing store, in a seedy part of Cleveland. And one day, three big guys walk into that store. One of them tries on a suit, likes it, and with his two buddies running interference, they walk out without paying. Michael Siegel chases them out the door, and as soon as he crosses the threshold, he has a massive heart attack. He essentially drops dead.
Wow.
And Jerry is now bereft. He's lost his dad. He's lost his hero. And when he goes to bed not long after that one night, with his pencil and paper, he transforms his character of Superman. Gone is the between before Superman. Gone is the hyphen. And gone is the bad guy act. And the new hero that he sketches out that night and that he runs across the street to his buddy Joe Shuster's house the next morning is a hero in the first depiction that Joe Shuster draws, swooping in to save a man who looks a whole lot like Michael Siegel, who is being robbed. And I think what this story that Jerry tells says is that the character that he invented was a hero to help bullied boys and bereft boys. And if there's everybody, I think, out there to some extent fits into one of those characterizations, that we're all looking for a hero who can help us take on this world that's often not very kind. And what we're really looking for is that people recognize that deep within all of us, we have that hero. If only those girls on the playground were smart enough to have seen that in this mild-mannered-looking kid, Jerry Siegel, there was a Superman within him.
Well, let me just pick up on that. And Bob Thompson, that's such a poignant beginning for Superman. And I think Larry is right, which is, and not just boys, I think a lot of people can identify with either feeling bullied or, as Larry said, bereft, and having this rich fantasy life.
I think he's absolutely right. And that is a very poignant story. And it reminds us that I think if it weren't for, and I think the basis of so much of our art and our vision, but certainly at the heart of the idea of the superhero, is, I think, this foundational, powerful feeling of powerlessness, and especially as that's manifest by being bullied. It's amazing. Bullying is such a nasty thing. It's so mean. We wish it would go away. But it is amazing how much rich culture people responding to having been bullied has brought about. And I think the whole Superman mythology once again comes from that sort of sense of adolescent powerlessness that one feels maybe most acutely in bullying situations.
Well, let me play another a clip, I should say, from Man of Steel, and this is Michael Shannon playing, I guess, the bad guy in Man of Steel. Here he is playing Zod, and we're introduced to him.
My name is General Zod. I have journeyed across an ocean of stars to reach you. Your world has sheltered one of my citizens. Surrender within 24 hours, or watch this world suffer the consequences.
Larry Tai, do you like Michael Shannon's portrayal of General Zod?
I thought he was a great Zod. I think that that there were three things in that movie that were unusual in terms of, I think, taking Superman to a different level, and I wasn't sure whether they were going to work.
One was the idea of having the guy who plays Superman be a British character.
Right.
And a hero that historically we thought of as an all-American hero. In fact, when we look back at the history, we see that from the very beginning, he was quite a global figure. He was given UN world citizenship. He was translated from the 1960s on. It was about 40 languages that Superman was translated into. And I think the idea that Henry Cavill could come along as a British actor and give us a compelling Superman is really interesting. I think it's also interesting that his trademark uniform, which stayed almost the same from the beginning, is missing for the first time in any live depiction or any other depiction, the underpants on the outside. And I think it's really interesting that they decided that they could tinker with something even as elemental as his uniform. The third thing that we see here, and it's more dramatic even than in the Christopher Reeves movies, is the Jesus Christ iconography, that if we ever wondered what the movie makers thought that Superman's religion was and the mythic story that they were playing with, we have this story. We've had from the beginning a story that a godlike figure played in the Christopher Reeves movies by Marlon Brando in a faraway place in the heavens sent his only son down to Earth to show mankind that it could be better than it thought it could be. And if we didn't get the hints that they were giving us in that first Christopher Reeve movie, we sure as heck got them in this Man of Steel movie, where Superman, when he's in the church consulting with a priest, we see this picture of Jesus Christ in the background, and there's no subtlety in terms of what they're giving us with the religious imagery here.
Well, and only because we have a break here, and if you don't mind, Robert Thompson, I'd like you to take the underpants part of what Larry Tye said, and we'll pick up on the Christian iconography. But do you, and it should be said that this Superman is really ripped. I mean, I don't know how else to describe him.
Yeah, I think the underpants, the outfit change was a great idea. I think one of the things standing in the way of Superman being able to be kind of adapted to a more contemporary society and culture was the fact that he kept wearing that outfit that goes all the way back 75 years. And somehow saving the world in that cape and the red panties on the outside was kind of a hard thing, I think, for a lot of people who weren't Superfan aficionados to accept. And not only does this change the costume, but we get a lot of backstory in the movie to show that the costume he's wearing, of course, is consistent with how people dressed on his planet. I do, after the break, though, want to get, I think the Christian iconography is really important to this movie and, I think, to a lot of what's happened in Superman before this movie.
Well, we are talking about Superman, 75 years of Superman, beginning our conversation, talking about the latest incarnation, Man of Steel, and we want to hear from you, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Bob Thompson from Syracuse University joining us, along with Larry Tye, author of a book called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lodge Lane Assisted Living supports WHYY. Lodge Lane is now accepting reservations for their new facility located near Wilmington, Delaware. Guided by time-honored Jewish traditions and values, Lodge Lane welcomes residents of all faiths in a supportive, friendly environment with round-the-clock staffing to assist with daily tasks. Featuring a variety of floor plans and amenities that include kosher and non-kosher dining and a secure memory wing. More at 302-764-7000 or lodgelane.org.
Just 7 days left in WHYY's fiscal year 2013. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Listeners like you have made a difference for WHYY all year with your support. Now, as we close in on the end of our fiscal year, listener support is more important than ever. Additional cuts to our budget as part of the federal sequester have put us behind where we need to be. Your support now will help keep us strong as we move into the coming year. Please visit WHYY.org and make a pledge. Thanks very much.
Roxy Music's Brian Ferry and Brian Eno shared a band, but not always the same musical vision. Ferry says their creative disagreements were part of the process.
An element of conflict in creativity is always a good thing. It's not that we were at war in the studio, but I think we were always vying to try and get our kind of stamp on the track.
That's Roxy Music's Brian Ferry this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscoen here on Radio Times, and today in this hour, we're talking about Superman. That's the Kinks, Wish I Could Fly Like Superman, going back to 1979. Again, talking with Larry Tye, author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, and Bob Thompson, professor of television, radio, and film at Syracuse University, where he's founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Larry Tye, going back to you, and I want to talk with both you and Bob Thompson about the Christian iconography. Interestingly, though, Superman is the creation of two Jewish guys in Cleveland.
Yes, so the truth is that over the last 75 years, Superman has been embraced by every religion on the face of the planet. We talked about the Christian story that they tell. He's taught in Sunday schools with this notion of Superman as a metaphor for the Christ story. If you Google the words Superman in Buddhism, you will see long treatises written on how Superman is the ultimate Zen-like hero. If you talk to atheists and agnostics, they say Superman instinctively knows the difference between right and wrong, and they ask, who needs God or religion? He's the perfect secular messiah. But I'm here to tell your listeners that I think Superman is in fact Jewish. And it wasn't just that he was created by two Jewish kids in a neighborhood that was 70% Jewish, or that he was published by two ex-pornographers, Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz, who were Jewish. But I think Jerry and Joe gave us lots of little hints on Superman's true ethnicity. I told you what the Christ version of the Superman story is. I'm going to give you another version, and that is that parents on a faraway world called Krypton try to save their firstborn son. And they save him by floating him out, let's say, into outer space, where he ends up in the middle of the American heartland, adopted by two of the most consummate Gentiles you would ever meet, named John and Martha Kent, who raise the baby as their own and realize over time they've got an exceptional child. And if that's not the story of Moses and Exodus, then I don't know what is.
Well, you know what, Larry, hold on to that thought only because I want to give Bob Thompson a chance to weigh in on that because I know he wants to talk about this as well. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I mean, this is all true. I mean, this story manages to integrate and coagulate all of these stories from all these religions, which of course have become some of the most important stories and myths and mythemes that we've come up with. Certainly, the Moses. I'm thinking back to the Christopher Reeves version where he comes floating through space, and he could have either been Moses in the basket through the bulrushes, or it was a manger to a great extent. And if I'm remembering correctly, when he first is naked in that pit in the Kansas farm field, he extends his two arms in this cross-like sort of way. So we've got all of these things, and the gods being adopted and raised by mortals goes back, of course, to Greek mythology and probably before, which brings me to the character of his adopted father, played by Kevin Costner, who I think was absolutely marvelous in this film, by the way. Yes, we've got the whole mosaic thing, but Kevin Costner does a better imitation of Joseph than I think anybody I've seen in a good long time. Of course, it's not his child, but he's raising it as such, and of course, it's got all these other sorts of powers. And because this whole thing works in all these different ways is why I think it's so exportable. This thing not only plays well everywhere on planet Earth, it would probably play well on other planets if they are inhabited by people.
Larry Tye, go ahead.
Sure. No, I think I love that, and I love the idea that he would be a success on other planets. I think he's such a successful character that everybody is looking for a reason to embrace him. My favorite pieces of evidence on what Jerry and Joe had in mind are that they called the character, as he came down from Krypton, Kal-El, which in Hebrew suggests the voice or the vessel of God. And I don't think that was an accident, but they also gave us my favorite piece of evidence on Superman's Jewish roots are there's a rule of thumb that any name that ends in the word M-A-N is one of two things. It is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, both. So next time your listeners see the word S-U-P-E-R-M-A-N, they should know it's not pronounced Superman, it is Superman.
Superman. Oh, that's fascinating. But Larry, you've also said that, and it looks like Warner Brothers has picked up on this theme and even went so far as to work with churches and send out notes for possible sermons. Do I have that right?
You have that exactly right. And they have their websites out there that are suggesting themes for ministers in case they don't know their own themes in terms of using this movie. The fact is that Warner Brothers spent nearly $250 million making the movie, and they're going to go out there and promote it every way they can, from taking it to religious schools to having cross promotions with everybody from Walmart to there are more co-marketers on this thing, and it is extraordinary. The last Superman movie in 2006, Superman Returns, only made about $500 million.
Only.
And Warner Brothers won't consider this one successful unless it doubles that.
Well, and it looks like it's well on its way to doing that. Again, we are talking about Superman with Larry Tye and with Bob Thompson, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, talking to the Superman heroes, or fans, I should say, out in the audience. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Bob, maybe because I'm a Freudian at heart, I'm always fascinated with these Superman stories because you have two fathers and the sort of relationship that Superman has with his biological father and then his adoptive father. Do you have thoughts about that?
Right. He does the Oedipal thing times two. He's got two fathers he's got to deal with. And,
exactly.
And depending on which iteration of this story depends on how precisely that happens. And that's what I think. Freudian, Christian, Jewish, religious, however one looks at this, it's such an adaptable story. I mean, if one looks at the evolution of this from the comic book to the comic strip to the radio to the TV shows to the movies, there was even a Broadway play. Didn't go very long, but there was even a Broadway play. This is one of those stories that can keep being adapted to and needs to be to each new generation. The Superman that we're seeing now in the theaters in Man of Steel is a very different, even though its foundations are similar, to what we were seeing in the comic books. And this is the kind of endurance that what we call now casually classics, but what real classics are, the, you know, Achilles and Aphrodite and Heracles, those stories are still relevant and they keep being updated. Shakespeare keeps working century after century. I don't think it's being hyperbolic to say that Superman is really one of those core kind of cultural nuggets that can be retold and adjusted and messed with, and they can take off the red underwear and they can do all these things, but it just keeps going and going and going.
Larry, let me pick up on something you said earlier, and this is about Man of Steel, and I agree with you, or I actually lost patience with the film in the last half hour when it was just this, as you said, kind of mayhem, these fight scenes that went on forever. I mean, in my view, ridiculous. I don't think I'm necessarily the intended audience for Superman. But why do you think Hollywood has to do that?
Well, I'm not sure that it does have to do that. I think it did that because it wanted to. It was as if it had they had put up a chart and said, these are all the things that we need as sort of our touchstones to draw back an audience. We need to give the creation story again, the origin story, so that we can bring in a new generation of young viewers. We need to have a fight scene because people go there, go to superhero movies to watch them fight. I thought they overdid it at the end with the fight scene, and I also thought that they weren't entirely true to the mythos of Superman. One of the things that Superman has stood for, we've got lots of dark heroes like Batman, we've got lots of fraught heroes like Spider-Man. One of the things that Superman has always stood for is he was the hero of the light, the hero who not just did the right thing, but he did it without collateral damage. He managed to never kill anyone. He managed to, you know, you would always be frustrated in the comic books because he would throw these bad guys, Lex Luthor or whoever it was, into jail, and you'd know that they'd break out of jail and they'd be back to do it again, and you wanted him sometimes to just do away with them. But Superman operated according to very strict rules. And as one of the longest writers ever of Superman, Mark Waid, commented on the new Man of Steel movie, Superman didn't lift a finger to move the fight scenes even a block away from where people wouldn't have been crushed by what was going on. There was no sense that that all the Earthlings who were getting mauled in this thing, that wasn't part of the Superman ethos. And I think that the fight scene was the weakest part of the movie, but by then I spent half my time when I was watching it watching other people watching it, and I think by then everybody in the theater that I watched it in was bought in enough that they went along with the fight scene.
Well, as I said, I don't think I'm necessarily the intended audience. Bob Thompson, your thoughts, and then we'll get to our callers.
Well, my favorite part of the movie by far was what happens before the mayhem starts. On the other hand, if Superman would have been able to, at that point in the movie, turn the other cheek or moved the battle out into the desert or whatever, I have to say I would have been dramaturgically bothered by that.
Oh, really?
Only insofar as I've grown up in the late 20th century. I'm waiting for the big battle. This also brings us back, though, to this idea that of darkening Superman. It's true, he was, of all of the superheroes, the one least existentially
challenged.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe part of bringing Superman into the 21st century, I mean, a lot has happened since 1938 in those 75 years. And part of that may be adapting Superman with a, let's face it, he was really beginning to emerge. His birth was taking place just before and during the Second World War, where that kind of ethos, in fact, made a lot of sense. Now it's 2013, and I think that ethos just may not seem credible to a lot of people.
Let me get Andrew from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Andrew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
So one thing that I was a little disappointed about in the new movie is that they went, again, like gangbusters hard for to redo the Christ parallel that you were all talking about. I mean, because the Christopher Reeve movie did a better job, I think, in the 78 Superman. And there are so many other ways to take the characters you guys have been talking about, and one that I think would be particularly relevant today is Superman, casting Superman as sort of the ultimate immigrant, because I think that's a really important part of the Superman mythos or story. That, you know, certainly you think about Joel Schuster and Jerry Siegel, they're both children. I don't know the entire backstory for both of them, whether their parents were directly from the old country or whether it was their grandparents, but surely in living memory, both of those kids had people in their families who remembered the old country, and that's what this story is to a certain degree. It's, you know, actually, I thought for a moment, I'm sorry, the one gentleman whose name I'm not remembering was talking about the Jewish parallel and with the story of Exodus. I thought he was going to be going through for the notion of, you know, trying to escape the Nazis.
Well,
Jewish family sending their only son to protect him from that.
Well, you know, and Andrew, you raise an interesting point about Superman as the ultimate immigrant. And Larry Tai, if the story reflects the times, and certainly he fought Nazis and grew up or was born during the Depression and then the communists came, do you think Andrew is onto something about sort of representing the ultimate immigrant?
I think Andrew's onto something in two ways. One is the Superman story has always been the story of the immigrant, and the immigrant who's not quite entirely comfortable in his new diaspora world. This was happening. Jerry was writing this story when all of his relatives, he came from Lithuania, his parents came from Lithuania, and all of his relatives who hadn't escaped at the time that his parents did were being slaughtered by the Nazis. And it was to the point of even the rocket ship that Superman took to come to Earth. I think that was a story of the Kinder transports, these that were used to save children during the Holocaust. I think this was extraordinarily the immigrant story, and I was hoping that that would be something that would play out more in the movie. It's one of the captivating features of Superman, and one of the reasons why, in an era when we all were either the children or grandchildren or were immigrants ourselves, that made the story so captivating a part of our popular culture at that time and today even.
What do you think, Bob Thompson?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think the caller and the response, perfect analysis. The big difference, of course, is that Superman is the ultimate immigrant. He comes from a long way away, but he comes by himself, and that's significantly different.
Maybe like those dreamers that we talk about today. But let me pick up on something that you both said, and I'll toss this first to you, Bob Thompson. But do you think it's the idea of Superman sort of passing, which is, you know, using his alter ego to live in the world, and, you know, people talk about passing in this culture, being and acting like somebody else?
Right. Well, I think, again, that's one of there's so many moving themes that can be developed in this very simple, basic Superman story, and that's another one. And one, I think we all, just as we were talking about how we've all in some way or another felt bullied, and therefore this fantasy of having superpowers is appealing, or we've all felt that we'd want justice done, and if we could do it, it would be appealing. I think everybody in some way, at some point in their lives, feel like they are passing. They are imposters in some way or another, and in many ways that might be part a very distinct a property of the American experience, especially if we go back to the big immigrant waves of the late 19th and early 20th century. And I think the whole Clark Kent Superman business is deep in the American soul.
Well, and Larry, we're almost up on a break here, but is there any more waspy name than Clark Kent?
I can't imagine one. His pug nose and his waspy name and all of his friends, not a Jew among them.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we will get back to our conversation. We are talking about Superman. In fact, talking about 75 years of Superman came to life, if I can say that, back in the 1930s. Of course, the new film out, Man of Steel, and talking with Larry Tye, author of a book called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, and with Bob Thompson. He's a professor of television, radio, and film at Syracuse University, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, June 25th in the school's offices on the 10th floor of 901 Walnut Street. Registration and more information available online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. The Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health, bringing health and healthcare together.
On the next Fresh Air, Questlove, the drummer with the hip-hop band The Roots, the house band for Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. They're about to move, along with Fallon, to The Tonight Show. Questlove has a new memoir about his life and obsessions, including Soul Train.
I could sit and watch all 1,100 episodes of just the intros of Soul Train.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
For decades, Sharon Salzberg's been writing about meditation and how it fits hand in glove with mindfulness and compassion. She played a crucial role in bringing Asian meditation practices to the West. And this year, she received the Learning from the Heart Award in Philadelphia. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, a conversation with New York Times bestselling author Sharon Salzberg. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about Superman.
Oh, Superman. Oh, Jama. Oh, Mom and Dad. Mom and Dad.
Laurie Anderson's 1981 Superman. Let's get back to our callers. And it looks like we have Pat joining us from Paulsboro. And Pat, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I saw Superman on Friday, and it was okay. But I was wondering why it was so devoid of humor. One of the things that the other manifestations of Superman did have was humor. And I was also wondering why they made Lois Lane so astute. She figured it out really quickly.
Well,
she's a Pulitzer in this movie, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Well, Pat, those are two great questions. And let me put the first one to you, Larry Tai, about the sort of absence of humor in this Man of Steel. Were you disappointed as Pat was?
I was disappointed. I think I grew up with the George Reeves Superman of the 1950s, and he lacked a lot of things, and one of the things he lacked was humor. He also lacked acting ability, and the only difference between his Clark Kent and his Superman was taking off or putting on his glasses. There was no attempt to sort of change his posture, change his voice. We had been given a really brilliant model for the first live-action Superman with Bud Collier, who played him on the radio for about 10 years. George Reeves came along, and I believed in him because I so wanted to believe as a young kid that he was our Superman that I wasn't even questioning when somebody would shoot a gun at him and six bullets would bounce off him. I never asked why he would have to duck when they threw the gun at him in frustration after the bullets had bounced off him. So he had humor only in our going back as adults, mm-hmm. and seeing all the humorous things about his trying to fly and all of that. Christopher Reeves, I agree with Bob that the best ever depiction of Superman was Christopher Reeves, who managed not just to make Clark really look different and act different than Superman, but managed to do it all with a laugh, and it didn't take anything away from his heroic qualities.
Bob Thompson, seems like you could get away with what Larry Tai described as George Reeves' Superman back in the 1950s because TV was so young.
Right. Our expectations were low. And it's interesting, he also mentioned Bud Collier, who was on the radio Superman, who would go on, most people know him as the game show host, to tell the truth was his big thing. And he had this massive pair of glasses in real life that Clark Kent would have been completely comfortable in. I brought Bud Collier on. I forgot what your question was.
Well, actually, no. You had said something earlier about Lois Lane, and in this new Man of Steel, Lois Lane actually, no, I don't think I'm giving too much away because it happens pretty early in the film. She knows who Superman is.
Right. Oh, yeah. You were saying you could get away with George Reeves in the 1950s. You couldn't now. And that's true. All of this stuff has got to be, it's got to be changed. And that's the whole, when Larry went off on his, that stand-up routine, which, by the way, is why his book on Superman is the best of, I don't know, 200 books that have been written Superman. I highly recommend it. But there is that sense now that I think part of the technology of computer graphics lets us make stuff look so realistic. There is so much verisimilitude that it's a lot harder to let stuff go by that doesn't kind of fit into that, that isn't as quote-unquote realistic. And all of that other stuff has to develop along with the technology to show a city collapsing, really looking like a city collapsing.
Well, I'm showing my baby boomer age here because we're going to play the first episode of the 1950s TV show where Superman meets his editor, Lois Lane, and Jimmy Olsen. Let's listen to this.
Who the blazes are you?
My name is Clark Kent, sir.
I told that girl not to...
Please, don't blame your receptionist, Mr. White. She doesn't even know I'm in here.
What do you mean she doesn't know you're in here? How'd you get past her?
Well, I didn't. You see, I came in through the window.
Is that supposed to be funny? That window's 28 stories above the ground, and the side of the building's as flat as this desk, except for a narrow lid.
Mr. White!
Who gave you permission to barge in here like a bull?
Just got a flash. There's a dirigible flying over the airport with a guy hanging from a rope.
Let's see, Jim.
I still want to know what...
Listen, Chief. An oil company blimp attempting to land at Metropolis Airfield in a high wind pulled 11 men aloft, clinging to the landing ropes. 10 dropped off safely, but one man is still hanging to a rope while the blimp cruises at 1,000 feet above the field, unable to land. More to follow.
You get down there right away, Lois, and you too, Olsen. Tell Ludlow to assign a photographer. Two of them.
Okay, Chief. Come on, Jim.
All right. Hello, Pete. Hold the 7-star for a page 1 replay. No, I don't know when. Just hold it.
Mr. White.
Now, look here, young man. I'm too busy to talk to you.
But if I could, that is, if that man could be rescued, and I got his exclusive story, sir.
What?
Would you give me a job?
Don't bother me.
But would you, Mr. White?
Yes, yes. Now, leave me alone.
Thank you, sir.
Larry Tye, I love that rat-a-tat-tat delivery.
I love it, and that's got to be a classic case. If somebody ever wondered what the difference was between laughing at you rather than with you, I think that the hearing that all these years later, you can't help but smile, partly because it brings back memories and partly because it was not great acting. I was in L.A. about 2 weeks ago and did a talk with a guy named Jack Larson, who was the Jimmy Olsen in that TV series from the 50s. And Jack is still alive and very well, and he thought it was the worst acting that he went on to become a producer of movies and to become a really serious star in lots of aspects of the film industry. And he can't believe how successful it was and the idea that replays are still being run all over the place. And he and Noel Neal, who played Lois for all but 1 year of the TV series, spent most of their later lives initially trying to run away from those characters, and in recent years have embraced it. Noel Neal started speaking on college campuses and realized that she was the role model for lots of professional women, and particularly women journalists, in an era when there weren't many role models around.
Sure.
It was Lois, who was beating the pants off of Superman and Clark Kent in getting the story, and that was really important for a lot of women who were looking for a strong professional model. And Jimmy Olsen couldn't go out, Jack Larson couldn't go out in public. Kids would mob him. Kids saw Jimmy Olsen as the character they could most relate to in that show, and Jack Larson was really wonderful at it.
Well, Bob Thompson, there is no Jimmy Olsen in Man of Steel. Did you miss him?
When someone pointed out to me that he wasn't there, I missed him a lot. I didn't miss him while I was watching it. I forgot that he wasn't there. So I guess the answer to that is...
not too much.
Is no. But it is interesting listening to that. And by the way, that makes great radio. You don't need to see the pictures of that clip you just played. But there is a sense that there's always a tendency to listen, especially to the old stuff, with a degree of irony. And I think if we went back and even watched the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, which I think were real minor masterpieces in their own way, you watch that with a little tongue-in-cheek as well. And maybe part of the reason there was virtually no humor in this current iteration is an attempt to not invite that kind of ironic viewing, which is very easy to do with any movie of superheroes because, of course, in realism, of course, the stories are so ridiculous.
Let me see what Mary from Bala Cynwyd has to say. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. So earlier this summer, I saw Iron Man 3, which I thought was outstanding, extremely well-written, extremely entertaining. I felt like the writers really understood the character inside and out and did a really great job of portraying the inner struggle that Iron Man had between his corporate personality and his personal life. I was really disappointed by Superman. I thought the casting was great. I thought the costumes were great. I thought the directing was great. I thought the writing was really horrible. Mm-hmm. And I really felt like it was because the writers had no idea who Superman was. And it made me wonder if, as a society, we've not only lost our ability to understand a hero like Superman, but have maybe also lost our ability to believe in a man like Superman who, you know, is all value and strength and tempers his strength with value. They really lost me when Superman killed the villain.
Well, that's interesting, Mary. Let me see what Larry Ty has to say. What do you think, Larry?
I'm with Mary on a lot of that. I think that in the old days, so the guy who did most of the serious rewriting of the first and what I think of as the best Superman movie, which was the first Christopher Reeve, was a guy named Tom Mankiewicz. And he and Dick Donner, who was a director, loved this character, grew up with the character, and really instinctually understood just who the character was. I'm not sure that the writers this time got it in the same sense. I had a feeling that they were telling a good story, but they were partly setting us up for, as I mentioned earlier, all the sequels to come, and the real essence of what made Superman different from all the other superheroes, I felt, was a little bit missing here.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Bob Thompson, it's interesting and perhaps not surprising. You know, every year or so, there's another Batman movie. There's Spider-Man, The Avengers, Iron Man. I saw previews to Wolverine. Seems like these superheroes are with us to stay.
Oh, there's no question about that. I guess I'm a little less picky about being true to their actual essence, because I think these superheroes, in many ways, belong to the ages. Yes, Schuster and Siegel, we can point to the people who created these characters, but once they sent them out into the world in their comic book, they essentially let them loose to be reinterpreted by different people and directors and actors and all of the rest of it. And I kind of like the sense that Superman doesn't have a definitive identity. The fact that he really is an organic, developing, fluid kind of character, I think, is one of the things that makes him continue to last.
Larry Ty, let me read something that Jerry Siegel wrote. I guess this is when the first Superman movie came out, and this apparently was in a trade magazine. I'm looking at The New Yorker. He said, "I, Jerry Siegel, the co-originator of Superman, put a curse on the Superman movie. I hope it super bombs. I hope loyal Superman fans stay away from it in droves. I hope the whole world becoming aware of the stench that surrounds Superman will avoid the movie like a plague." And apparently he was concerned about the people that would, quote, exploit and profit from Superman, who are greedy and selfish. Does that sound like the Jerry Siegel that you wrote about in your book?
It does, but it actually, I would put a little twist on what he was doing then. Jerry was upset about maybe exploitation of Superman. What he was more upset about is exploitation of Jerry Siegel and Joe Schuster. If you go back to the original time when they sold their story in 1938, they were so desperate, having spent 5 years trying to sell it, that they sold it to the old DC Comics for a combined total to be divided between the two of them for the rights to Superman in every medium forever for $130.
Jeez.
And what he was really upset about when he wrote the letter that you were just reading from is that Warner Brothers was going to be making hundreds of millions of dollars from this new movie and that he wasn't going to be cut in on it. And what ended up happening, partly as a result of the campaign that letter helped prompt, Jerry Siegel and Joe Schuster got annual annuities paid to them that were quite generous and helped them a lot in their life. They weren't as much as they thought they deserved, but they were more than they were ever getting, and they went from poverty to living in relative comfort for the rest of their lives. But they went from the earliest days, they were going back and forth perpetually between being delighted at how famous their character was and being embittered that they had given up the rights for so little money.
And Bob Thompson, I feel like I've heard that story before.
Oh yeah, they weren't the first, and oftentimes immortality and a big bank balance are not compatible.
And is this, I mean, you teach popular culture. Do you find there's a lot of student interest in Superman?
Yes, and you can always tell how old someone is by what Superman they consider the definitive Superman. For me, it's the, and I agree, I think the best one was the first Christopher Reeve movie in the 1970s. For others, depending when you were born and what you saw, most of my students had never heard the radio version or seen the early TV version. But I am convinced that 75 years from now, when we're celebrating the 150th anniversary, there will still be new Superman movies. By that time, Superman might be unrecognizable to us and Schuster and Siegel and the original versions of it, but they'll be recognizable to the people in the times that are watching it. And I think that's what really makes a classic character.
Well, Bob Thompson and Larry Tai, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much. And we do want to close things out with Patricia Moran as Lois Lane lamenting her love in Superman from the 1966 Broadway musical It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. Words by Lee Adams, music by Charles Strauss.
Oh, how I wish I weren't in love with Superman. A wasted life is all I've got with Superman. To hope that it could ever be is just a schoolgirl's fantasy. Oh, is there no one else for me but Superman? Does he ever hold me? Has he ever told me he could care? Tell me, please, when will he learn it's not some silly fly-by-night affair? I know that I should find myself another man, someone to give my love to, as I know I can. A homey type who'll stay around, a guy with both feet on the ground. But till he comes, my heart is bound to Sue.